You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Good evening. We are Leaping Cholla podcast. We're reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. And we're on section 69.
Yes, we are.
Shall we just dive right in?
Sure.
Okay.
69, lived experience and anthropology. The fact that anthropology is still today, or even again, made the center of worldview dogmatics shows more convincingly than any historiological proof of lines of dependence that mankind is once more endeavoring to place itself back completely on the Cartesian foundation. Whether anthropology is dressed in an enlightened moral, psychological, natural, scientific, human scientific, personalistic, Christian or political ethnic coiffure is a matter of utter indifference for the decisive question, i.e. for the question of whether the modern era is grasped as an end and another beginning is sought, or whether the decline that has been in effect since Plato is perpetuated and insisted on, which ultimately can still happen only through the conviction that one's lack of any presentment is in fact an overcoming of the tradition. Should I just finish? Or do you want to
go?
That was a pretty hefty...
It's a hefty paragraph.
Yeah.
Why don't you finish?
Okay. It is thereby quite in order if the lack of a presentment, not to say lack of responsibility, extend so far that someone might put on airs claiming to have overcome the Cartesian philosophy, while at the same moment no contemporaries surmise anything of this play of the lack of presentment. Just as at the time of neo-Kantianism, however, the current history of the age did not recognize the still quite considerable learning and careful work that was done, so today's age of lived experience will make even less of a fuss with respect to this boring and commonplace mock-up of its own superficiality.
Okay. So he's used this word anthropology before.
Mm.
Now, when we hear anthropology, we think of people digging up pot shards and arrowheads and burn sites and bones and surmising about early cultures based on artifactual evidence. But that is not obviously what he's talking about. I would say anthropology is probably just a catchphrase for a tendency to human center sciences and philosophies and studies, and it obviously lines up with lived experience. So in a sense, anthropology is the primary scientific praxis of a culture infatuated by lived experience. So in a sense, anthropology is just an extension of the lived experience obsession, and the way in which lived experience and its emphases infuse all of the humanities and turn them into a human-centric form of knowledge.
I feel like it could be seen as the scientific backing of what lived experience, or the supposed scientific backing.
Yeah, that's right. It's in a sense. Yeah, that's right.
The
it's
human scientific backing, or something.
Yeah, right. That's right. It's theory that's trying to justify and confirm the predominance of lived experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So it is today the center of a worldview dogmatics, and this shows more convincingly than any historiological proof or lines of dependence, or sort of proof of lines of dependence, that mankind is once more endeavoring to place itself back completely on the Cartesian foundation. The Cartesian foundation, of course, is the I think, therefore I am. It's the transcendent ego. It's the transcendent subject. It's, in a sense, it's that the thinking self and the, the conscious self are at the center of the world and the center of all experience. Whether anthropology is dressed in an, so then we have this little list here, enlightened moral, so coiffure, it really
means dress up?
Yeah, it means hairdo.
Hairdo?
Yeah, like an extravagant hairdo.
So. I always imagine it as like Victorian dress up, but yeah.
Yeah, hairdo's a coif. Cooler. It's like a coif. We use that phrase, coif.
Hairdo.
Coiffure. I'm not quite sure how to say it, but it elicits the vision of an exaggerated, eccentric, showy dress up thing. Mm. And so, yeah, so anthropology is dressed up in this hairdo of the enlightened moral, meaning the approach that an enlightened moralistic perspective on the world is the proper one. The psychological, natural, scientific, that would be, again, kind of a psychological interpretation of everything as a psyche as the center of representation and determination. Human, scientific, personalistic. That's probably just, personalistic would be, the personality, the personal, the private, the sentimental, the science of the human, almost like, again, tending toward the psychological with ideas of, the templates and the formats of the human personality, human character. Christian or political ethnic, whether this anthropology is dressed up in any of these forms, all of which are kind of the same, they're all just liberalism, is a matter of utter indifference for the decisive question, i.e. for the question of what. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how it's dressed up. It doesn't matter how liberalism dresses itself up. For the question, the important thing is, whether the modern era is grasped as an end and another beginning is sought. So are we trying to get out of the modern era? Are we trying to move on? Or the decline that has been in effect since Plato is perpetuated and insisted on, which ultimately can still happen only through the conviction that one's lack of any presentiment is in fact an overcoming of the tradition.
Okay, I got it all into that last sentence.
Yeah.
Like, how does one's lack can still happen?
Yeah. That's what requires some explication. I mean, so obviously what he's saying is there's two decisive questions here. Are we going to pursue the other beginning? And are we going to make a break with the multi-millennial tradition of metaphysics, as I've been counseling in this book? Or are we going to continue the decline that Plato started? And that decline, that perpetuation of that decline, that insistence on that decline can only happen through a conviction that lies at the center of liberalism, that one's lack of any presentiment is in fact an overcoming of the tradition. So there's a lying to oneself that, in a sense, the idea is that one feels like one is overcoming the tradition, right? By lacking a presentiment. Now, what is a presentiment? You know, the technical definition is an intuitive feeling about the future, especially one of foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be saying that there is a tendency to insist that lacking any presentiment about the future, mm-hmm. lacking any opinion about the future, so being kind of maybe falsely impartial or neutral or indifferent toward the future is being put forward as a supposed overcoming of the Platonic tradition. And mm-hmm. I think Heidegger is saying it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
That we need not just to say, oh, I have real no opinion about the future, but rather we need another beginning that takes a different approach to the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what?
Or,
go ahead.
I was saying, I also first read it a little like not looking for the other beginning. So in a way being happy in the current beginning or the Cartesian foundation, the Cartesian reality is in a way a lack of presentment and seems to be an overcoming of tradition, perhaps.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, this word presentiment is in German Ahnungslosigkeit or Ahnungs. So lack of presentiment is Ahnungslosigkeit. And Ahnung is it's a complicated word. It means idea, notion, presentiment, indeed, suspicion, hunch, premonition, feeling, provision. So it seems to be an idea about the future that involves a little bit of worry and foreboding. I'm not quite sure why Heidegger is concentrating on it here, like what the real active force of that word is, but I'm going to keep reading and see if we can discover a little more.
Well, I guess I'm reading that in terms of like the lack of a presentment, so the lack of, let's say, like a sense of, in a way, foreboding, danger of the path we're currently on.
Yeah, that's right. The idea that everything's going just fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I think that's what it is.
Yeah, the way we're thinking is just really good.
Yeah, exactly. We're doing exactly what we should. We're making progress. Things are going great.
Mm-hmm.
Liberalism is the future. We should just keep going with it. And by feeling that, mm-hmm. I am indeed overcoming the tradition
mm-hmm.
Of decline that has been in effect since Plato.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What that decline that has been in effect since Plato is...
Mm-hmm.
is a complicated philosophical question. I don't think we can get too into it here. I think we've touched on it, but I would mm-hmm. say in general, it is being abandoned by being.
Mm-hmm.
It's the forms and interacting with the forms as if they are real. It's identity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an obsession with essences, values,
mm-hmm.
Metaphysical abstract realities over what's actually occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Plato is seen as the father of philosophy, so it's also just kind of the philosophical tradition as it's been handed down to us and carried on mm-hmm. Generation to generation. But getting more into Plato and how he set us on this path of identitarian metaphysics is definitely an interesting topic.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just have to get to another time.
Mm-hmm.
So we move to the second paragraph. It is thereby quite in order if the lack of a presentiment, not to say lack of responsibility, which I think is cool because it's like, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Liberalism is going great.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I'm not responsible for its outcome.
Mm-hmm.
It is thereby quite in order if the lack of a presentiment extends so far, so in a sense, meaning it's quite a part of this world that we're talking about, that this lack of representation and lack of responsibility extends so far that someone might put on airs claiming to have overcome the Cartesian philosophy, while at the same moment, no contemporaries surmise anything of this play of the lack of presentiment. So meaning, oh, I've overcome the Cartesian philosophy, and nobody even notices that it's actually just kind of a lie. Just as at the time of Neo-Kantianism, however, the current history of the age did not recognize the still quite considerable learning and careful work that was done. So today's age of lived experience will make even less of a fuss with respect to this boring and commonplace mock-up of its own superficial officiality. Yeah, so just as at the time of Neo-Kantianism, the current history of the age did not or does not recognize the still quite considerable learning and careful work that was done. You know, that's a philosophical, nice philosophical esoterica, you know. I think he's saying that with the Neo-Kantians, people didn't quite realize how much work they had done and how much learning they had taken on. And the same as today. I think the idea is that I think he's comparing Neo-Kantianism to the lived experience philosophy, and that those both being kind of superficial, popular philosophical trends that cover up real work and learning that was carried on beneath them and before them and around them. And obviously he's calling it all superficial. I guess that's it. I mean, I think that's... That's totally. The section.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think the lesson is that we have all these different anthropological viewpoints, these perspectives that liberalism can take. The enlightened moral, the psychological, national, scientific, the human, scientific, personalistic, Christian, political, ethnic, etc. But they are all superficial dress-ups for a human-centric Cartesian transcendental subject view that perpetuates the decline that Plato started, where we become less and less sort of aware of what's around us, and less and less aware of the abandonment of being, we carry on in our superficial lived experience liberal ways.
There's a footnote here. Do you see that?
I don't have that in my Kindle version.
Well, it's right at the top. It's the title, 69 Lived Experience in Anthropology. Do you see a footnote there?
Oh, yeah.
I'll read it because it's right here in my book. So 4 is the footnote to the title.
Yeah.
What is lived experience? How it's raining leads to the anthropological way of thinking. How lived experience is an end because it unconditionally confirms machination.
Yeah. It's kind of... We've been saying that. He's been saying that.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, we now get to the gigantic.
70.
Right?
Yes. Which is gigantic.
A shift in topic because we've been on machination, lived experience for a while.
Although the footnote there, the gigantic, the footnote is 5 and it says CF machination, which I guess means another word for machination. Yeah, or what does it mean?
Or related to machination. Yeah, I think we're going to hear.
Okay.
We're going to hear what they have to do with each other. But yeah, cool.
Okay.
Let's read some.
At first, we must take our bearings from what is closest and characterize the gigantic two as something objectively present at hand in order to let resound at all the abandonment by being and thus the predominance of the distortion as machination of
being.
Being.
I believe that's Usha.
Usha.
That's physis.
Oh, a physis.
Nature, nature,
physics.
Birth, the nature of one's personality, quality, property. Yeah, nature.
Okay. As soon as machination for its part is grasped in terms of the historicality of being, however, the gigantic reveals itself as something else. It is no longer the representable object of something quantitative without limit. Instead, it is quantity as quality. Quality is here meant as the basic character of the quail, of the what, of the essence of being itself.
Yeah, I think that's pronounced quale.
Quale, okay.
Yeah, I believe.
Not quail.
Probably not quail. I mean, that's a fair
quail
enough.
Is
that's
a 2-year-old word for cute. Yeah, right. Cute quail.
Yeah, it's quale.
Quale,
okay. Quality or property as perceived or experienced by a person. Qualia. Qualia probably a synonym of that. I don't know. Qualia is in the context of philosophy, qualia refers to the subjective, qualitative, or experiential aspects of consciousness. So yeah, that's not the same thing. Qualia is, I think it's a quiny. I think Quine made that word popular. I don't know. I'm not very well read. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Should I?
Yeah.
A little more.
We know quantity, quality.
That's probably quantity, quality.
Yeah, in Greek.
In Greek.
As categories, i.e. in relation to judgment. Yet it is not a matter here of a changeover of one category into another, a dialectical, intrinsically representational mediation of the forms of representation, but is instead a matter of a change in the history of being itself. This latter changeover is prepared by the determination of beingness on the basis of techne and idea in Greek to represent and to bring before oneself involve the how wide and how far, i.e. the characters of distance in relation to beings as objects, even if no definite spatial things or relations are thought of.
Yeah, we should probably. So this quantity quality thing, I was recently reading Heidegger's Logic, and he has a huge section on quantity versus quality and the distinctions between them. It's a big topic in German philosophy. I'm not sure I understood what Hegel was. Did I see it was reading Heidegger?
Yeah,
Hegel's Science of Logic. And he has a whole quantity quality thing in there. I'm not sure I understood any of it, but so let's look at this. First, we must take our bearings from what is closest and characterize the gigantic as something objectively present at hand in order to let resound at all the abandonment by being and thus the predominance of the distortion of nature. So the gigantic, the distortion of nature, the abandonment by being, all kind of the same thing. As soon as machination for its part is grasped in terms of the historicality of being, the gigantic reveals itself as something else. So gigantic and the gigantic and machination are different. If we look at the historicality of being, it is no longer the representable object of something quantitative without limit. So the gigantic is no longer the representable object of something quantitative without limit. So it's not just a huge quantity. Instead, it is quantity as quality. That makes sense, right? Quality is here meant as the basic character of the quale, of the what, of the essence, of bang itself. So the gigantic is not just a huge mass. It takes on a quality, a qualitative aspect. It gains a character. It becomes a thing. It takes on a bang. It takes on life. It is more
related to its quantity.
Yeah, that's right. And it's more than the sum of its parts. It takes on a noumenon, I guess, or a spiritual aspect, spirit aspect. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's actually an anxiety correlation to this.
What's that?
So one of like the main ways that anxiety is characterized or encouraged to be thought about to detach from it is if you think about basically the consequences of something as like it somehow sort of takes over the likelihood or the possibility or the likelihood of it happening. So to me, that relates to quantity as quality because...
What do you mean it takes it over?
So if the intrusive thought is, I might kill myself, the sort of terribleness of that thought takes over and becomes what's thought about as opposed to if it's actually a possibility that I would kill myself.
Okay. Yeah.
So that, and to me that
so the
quantity, I guess I'm equating quantity to in a way, well, maybe I'm doing it the quantity as quality. Oh, maybe I just am saying it the exact opposite of what he's saying.
Say it again.
So the idea in anxiety literature is that you don't want to confuse basically how bad it would be if something happened with the likelihood of something happening.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I actually maybe am looking at it in exactly the inverse. So in a way, because I was relating quantity to the likelihood. I mean, I was relating it the wrong way, maybe.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just thinking about a confusion of basically different factors, right? So yes. Like the likelihood of something yes. happening versus like the emotional feeling of something happening and confusing yes. them.
Yeah, well, I think you're spot on. I think there is a connection. I mean, I think that if you have a presentiment of something happening, if you're fixated on the concept, like it's okay killing yourself, right? And so you have a real experience with that as a outcome, as a fact, as an event, as a reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I would kill myself, I would die, I would be dead, my death would be everywhere, the world would be without me, I would be gone. It has all these factors. It's in a sense a quantity. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I can see that you're right, that it just has a mass.
A gigantic, I guess.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but it's an experiential mass.
Yeah.
You relate to it as an experiential mass. And that mass is just a bunch of facts, none of which have happened. Mm-hmm. But you're connected to them via possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And because the facts are so massive, they take on this quality of being possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? So the quantity becomes a quality.
Yeah.
So the massiveness of the consequences leads to the likelihood of their outcome. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's not good logic. Mm-hmm. That's not, mm-hmm. that doesn't really work. The quantity being turning into the quality. And then it all becomes the gigantic. Mm-hmm. And so in a way you're right. We can see the way quantity and quality interact to emanate the gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing becomes gigantic. And it becomes gigantic. I mean, in a sense, you killing yourself and all the massive factualities of that event aren't gigantic unless they're coupled with a sense of likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes really gigantic and you become really scared because it's really huge,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is the quantity mixing with the quality that creates the gigantic and makes it something that must be reckoned with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's read on, because he says, we know quantity, quality as categories in relation to judgment. So we judge things according to quantity. We judge things according to quality. As we just talked about, we judge experiences versus likelihoods of events. Mm-hmm. Yet it is not a matter here. So he's talking about the coalescence of quantity and quality, the flowing of quantity into quality, quantity becoming quality, quality becoming quantity, etc. It's not a matter here of changeover in of one category into another, of a dialectical. And that's, you know, again, he's, mm-hmm. anytime you use the word dialectical, you're conjuring Hegel. And that's what I said, like Hegel talks a lot about quantity and quality and how they the categories change over into each other in a dialectical. So it's not a matter here of a changeover of one category into another, a dialectical, intrinsically representational mediation of the forms of representation, but is instead a matter of a change in the history of being itself. So this quantity into quality, quality into quantity is about the history of being itself. Mm-hmm. This latter changeover, changeover that is about the history of being itself, is prepared by the determination of beingness on the basis of techne and idea. So beingness has been established as being based in techne and idea, and that enables this changeover. To represent and to bring before oneself involve the how wide. To represent and bring before oneself. So beingness is brought before us via idea, right? Mm-hmm. And techne. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to make sure that is, yes, techne, yes, exactly. Representation itself, he's saying, involves a how wide and how far aspect. Mm-hmm. They involve the characters of distance in relation to beings as objects, even if no definite spatial things or relations are thought of. Mm-hmm. So what he's saying is that because we have come to interact with being as an idea, mm-hmm. not as bang, right? Not mm-hmm. as an imminent appropriating experiential time spatial field, mm-hmm. but as idea, as representation, we are having a quantitative experience via in that representational act, typified by questions of sort of how wide and how far, which are quantitative determinants. Mm. You only ask how wide something is or how far something is, mm-hmm. how long and how wide, when you're talking about spatial size. Mm-hmm. But he makes the really interesting point that in our representational space, we actually engage with quantitative determinants. Mm-hmm. Right. And mm-hmm. so that's where the quality into quantity, quantity into quality. Mm-hmm. Now you can, if we were to, interestingly enough, go and try to map that onto your anxiety thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Then as you're having the quantity component in that grid is your mass experience of killing yourself. Mm-hmm. And all the imaginings and mm-hmm. feelings and projections that make up the idea of you killing yourself and being dead. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a mass. But just like in representation, there are physico-spatial questions that come into play through that representation. So how far and how long, how wide and those kind of things. Just like in representation, those things come into play. In your mass experience of killing yourself, likelihood, possibility, imbricates itself into all that. And so the mass starts to, massiveness starts to influence the likelihood and the possibility. So the thinking becomes blurred because the two domains, the domain of mass and likelihood, are they're kind of cognitively and systematically, as he's about to use the word systematically, they're systematically involved with each other. So you can't separate them. You're having a, you're having both experiences at once, and they're influencing each other. And just the massiveness of the idea of killing yourself is almost dragging likelihood along with it, and increasing your sensation and your judgment of the likelihood simply because of the massiveness of the experience. I also think that there is a problem here in how liberalism has equipped us to deal with the gigantic. The gigantic is fine. There's nothing wrong with the gigantic. I mean, the world is absolutely huge, right? It's gigantic. The gigantic becomes a problem when it takes on a quality, right? And that quality becomes something that's scary. Takes on a quality. That quality is something like threatening, mysteriously evil, devious, right? Amoral, suspicious, tricky, malicious, blah, blah, blah. Savage, undemocratic, fascistic, right? Hitlerian, right? All these things. The massiveness takes on a quality, and that's when it becomes scary. So liberalism has a hard time just accepting the big, the huge, without a quality. It must imbue it with a quality, and that quality is usually just, it's scary. So, So, in other words, you know, I'm going to kill myself is a mass. It's a gigantic. It's a huge thought, and it feels huge, right? It's so huge. But again, size is not scary unless it has a quality. Do you know the definition of the sublime?
No.
That's okay. I only learned it very recently. The definition of sublime is something that is super huge, like just big on scale, that could, if it were to decide to or change its trajectory, destroy us immediately. But is not doing that. And in a sense, that makes it beautiful and powerful and sublime. So for instance, you know, something sublime is, let's say, clouds crashing against a snow-capped mountain, right? The sublime. Well, you know, the idea is that, you know, we could be crushed. We're so small compared to these mountains, and but they're beautiful. So it's, in a sense, it's beauty that could be dangerous because it's so huge, but has decided not to. So it almost comes across as gracious. And so that's kind of the opposite of what we might call the liberal gigantic, because the sublime has been assumed to be unthreatening, which makes it beautiful. The gigantic is assumed to be threatening, which makes it horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also think there's something in the like you were saying, like in the representativeness of beings in the quantitative, how wide, how far. Actually, I guess the next paragraph is about representation. Maybe we should read that.
Yeah, why don't you go for it?
Representation as systematic turns this distance, as well as its overcoming and securing, into the basic law of the determination of objects. The project of representation, in the sense of an anticipating, planning, organizing grasp of everything, before everything is already grasped in particulars and individuals, this representation finds no limits in what is given and seeks to find none. Instead, the limitless is decisive, not as what flows by or is merely more of the same, but as bound by no limit of the given, by nothing that is or could be given as a limit. In principle, nothing is impossible. Indeed, that term is hated. That is to say, everything is humanly possible as long as everything is calculated in every respect and in advance and the conditions are provided.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe we need to do the next little paragraph too, because I feel like it ties back. Oh, it's hard. How do you know when to stop?
Yeah, keep reading.
Yeah. Thus, we can already see that it is not a matter of a changeover of the quantitative into the qualitative, but is a matter of recognizing the original essence of the quantitative and of the possibility of its representation, calculability, in the essence of the reigning of both representation as such and the objectifying of beings.
Yeah, I think that's enough.
Yeah.
Yes. I think he kind of heads in a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
So representation, which is a system, creates this distance or has this distance, this sense of things being close or far, as well as its overcoming and securing, overcoming distances, securing distances, turns this distance into the basic law of the determination of objects. So objects are close or far, they have distance within the system of representation, and that's the basic law of their determination. The project of representation, in the sense of an anticipating, planning, organizing grasp of everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So representation is a anticipatory, planning, organizational grasp of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs before anything is already grasped in particulars and individuals. This representation finds no limits in what is given and seeks to find none. So it has no limits, and it is not interested in finding them. Mm-hmm. Instead, what's decisive about it is that it is limitless, not as what flows by or is merely more of the same, but is bound by no limit of the given, by nothing that is or could be given as a limit. In principle, nothing is impossible. Indeed, the term impossible is hated. That is to say, everything is humanly possible as long as everything is calculated in every respect and in advance and the conditions are provided. Thus, we can already see that it is not a matter of a changeover of the quantitative into the qualitative, but is a matter of recognizing the original essence of the quantitative and of the possibility of its representation in the essence of the reigning of both representation as such and the objectifying of beings. So representation as a system sets up a determination of objects or a law of the determination of objects where we grasp things according to this system, in a space of no limits, and we don't want any limits because everything has to be possible within the world of representation. And the quantitative into the qualitative, this little relates a little to what you were saying earlier. We can already see that it's not a matter of a changeover of the quantitative into the qualitative, but it's a matter of recognizing the original essence of the quantitative. Mm-hmm. And of the possibility as a represent of its representation. So again, what is the original essence of the quantitative? Mm-hmm. What is the original essence of you killing yourself? Mm-hmm. Of the fear, of the mass of the fear, mm-hmm. right? And the original essence, again, is that it's scary, mm-hmm. right? So, which is, in a sense, a quality. So the qualitative is embedded in the quantitative via the impossibility that is at the heart of the system of representation, mm-hmm. the fetish of impossibility, the fetish of no limits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have something to say about all that in relation to anxiety?
I guess I'm still trying to figure it out, but I mean, obviously this idea of the impossibility is like a big one, that like anything is possible at any point.
Yeah. Yeah.
As long as it's been if it's calculated, it's possible, or if it's thought or represented as possible.
Yeah.
And then I think he actually pulls in the quantitative to the possibility of its representation. I'm not quite, haven't quite figured that out, but I think it's just the calculability and the idea of probabilities of something happening. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like he's almost even talking about that. Mm-hmm. And representation as calculation, but I'm not quite sure. I don't know. They all seem very intertwined, but I'm not totally sure how.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, recognizing the original essence of the quantitative and of the possibility. So he's saying the possibility, not that anything is possible, but just the possibility of its representation, calculability. What does that mean?
Sorry, ask me again. I was reading on. Go ahead. Ask me again.
What does it mean when it says, like, I get the original essence of the quantitative, or matter of recognizing the original essence of the quantitative, I don't quite get, and of the possibility of its representation, calculability. What does that mean?
So he's repeating himself and saying that we're not talking about a changeover of the quantitative into the qualitative. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, they're not separated. It's not we move from the quantitative to the qualitative. Mm-hmm. As if we're moving from stone A to stone B. It's actually their one thing.
In liberalism or in general?
In a world in which the gigantic can come to be a source of or a product of machination. Yeah.
Yeah.
Liberalism. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The identitarian Platonic liberal world that we live in. Yeah. Into the quantitative. It's a matter, but so it's not a matter of quantitative crossing over into the qualitative.
Okay. We
made that clear. Now, the next part is, yes, a little thornier. It is a matter of recognizing the original essence of the quantitative and of the possibility of its representation in the essence of the reigning of both representation as such and the objectifying beings. I see, yes. Okay, so it's a matter actually of recognizing
What is the matter?
So
the first beginning or the other beginning?
No.
Or what?
No. The gigantic.
The gigantic, okay.
The power that the gigantic has gained.
Okay.
Is not just due to this changeover from the quantitative to the qualitative.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Got it, yeah.
It's actually due to understand the gigantic. We need to understand that the original essence of the quantitative and the possibility of its representation, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the essence of the quantitative? Mm-hmm. How do we relate with just sheer quantity?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we understand the possibility of its representation?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We can only understand those via the fact that we live in a world where these two things reign.
Mm-hmm.
Representation as such and the objectifying of beings.
Yeah.
So via the fact that representation and the objectification of beings
mm-hmm.
is the reigning feature of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Due to those two facts, we end up with a state of affairs in which the original essence of the quantitative and the possibility of its representation, right,
mm-hmm.
lead to or involve the mm-hmm. concept of the gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very mm-hmm. they're interwoven,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
The gigantic is only possible because we have a world in which representation as such and the objectifying of beings leads to
mm-hmm.
or dominates how we understand the essence of the quantitative and the possibility mm-hmm. of its representation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So in order to, I would say, deconstruct this dominance of the gigantic,
mm-hmm.
we need to go at these two facts, the dominance of representation and the dominance of the objectifying of beings.
Mm-hmm.
We need to ask ourselves, what lies outside representation? What kind of experiences do we have outside representation? How have we become over dependent on representation? How is representation taken over our thinking?
Mm-hmm.
How is objectification taken over our thinking? What is non-objectification? How we can get outside objectification?
Mm-hmm.
How can we essentially really deflate and deflect and escape the dominance of representation of objectification in mm-hmm. order to reorient ourselves to a new essence of the quantitative and a better understanding of the possibility of its representation, so that we can, in a sense, defer or deflate what the gigantic has become to us, what we have made mm-hmm. the gigantic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the gigantic is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a problem because it's, in a sense, it's I would call it the systemic endemic tumor of liberalism.
Mm.
It's liberalism's tumor.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a tumor is just a mass, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's even a word we use for it. It's just a mass.
Mm-hmm.
But if its quality is that it's cancer.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a problem.
Right.
And I would say the gigantic is a cancerous mass
mm-hmm.
for liberalism
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because it occludes clear thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It prevents clear thinking. It not only fosters and dogmatizes representation and objectification,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
it's also the product of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it just simply exacerbates the abandonment by being
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of our metaphysical degradation
mm-hmm.
via liberalism's identitarian system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how would you, how would you break that down in terms of anxiety, or how would you...
Well, it is anxiety. It's really a map of anxiety, what I just described.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, it is.
If the gigantic, if the essence of the quantifiable
mm-hmm.
is representation,
mm-hmm.
right? Think about
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
representation is a system of no limits.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then the every quantity becomes limitless.
Mm-hmm.
and every quantity becomes embedded with the quality of the terrible.
Right.
And that is anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, bang, it's this word we've used so much, can just be thought of probably as the non-gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
The gigantic is a noumenal force that we have imbued with energy and power and possibility due to our limitless representational addiction and our objectification of being, which is in fact the abandonment by being. Mm-hmm. And it's a force that, and the thing is, the gigantic doesn't even have to be that big.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a little news story where somebody does one terrible little thing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There's one terrible little crime in one terrible little town and one terrible little house at one terrible little moment,
mm-hmm.
that took about 5 terrible seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes a gigantism,
mm-hmm.
becomes a gigantic thing because it represents something.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
We use these words even just describe what's going on. It represents something,
right.
And so then it's not. I mean,
it represents that it's limitless, and anybody could do it.
Exactly. There's some scary guy living in some scary little place a million miles from your house, right? And he mm-hmm. does something to somebody that never is going to have anything to do with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a real tangible way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what it represents
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
can keep you awake all night
mm-hmm.
and drive you insane.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. That's what Heidegger's talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
The bang is the event.
Mm-hmm.
The gigantism, the machination, the lived experience, the liberalism, the identity is the representation of what it represents to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as we see more and more today, liberalism is the experience of representation.
Yeah.
Things that aren't actually that scary if considered just as isolated events.
Yeah, right.
Become terrifying because they represent so much
mm-hmm.
to liberals. And liberals can't sleep at night
mm-hmm.
because of what things represent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like our friends who we had the conversation with when I said, yeah, I think we should stop funding the private universities.
Mm-hmm.
That the counter statement was, well, that's the end of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if we stopped federal money to the private universities, the country would not go away.
Yeah.
But it to this person, it represented that.
Right.
And so they're having an actual experience of the country dying.
Right.
And going away.
Right.
Because some funding is cut to some hyper-rich universities.
Yeah.
So it's a representation that this person is experiencing.
Yeah, right.
That's being abandoned by being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's quintessential liberalism now.
Yeah.
And I think that's the experience that those of us who have dipped away from liberalism are having, and looking from the outside at liberalism, we're saying, look at those people and how unbelievably focused on, fixated by, traumatized by, and in a sense, deluded by
mm-hmm.
representations
mm-hmm.
they are.
Mm-hmm.
Look at them. Like, they're so enwrapped in what everything represents.
Mm-hmm. And the worst case scenario of that.
Yes, exactly. That they're not really able to breathe. They're not mm-hmm. really able to encounter bang. They're not really able to just kind of have an experience of events mm-hmm. that kind of, they're not even concerned with what they mean, what they represent. It's mm-hmm. all just such big meanings now,
mm-hmm.
big representations.
Yeah.
It's the death of democracy. Right. Like the phrases can't get big enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the Holocaust. All over again.
It's the Nazis
are here. It's the reign of fascism. It's the death of the country. It's the end of America. It's a constitutional crisis.
Right.
The phrases, it's just a conveyor belt of huge, gigantic phrases now. Like next week, there's going to be another one.
And then there's another one.
Right. It's the death of due process. It's the end of the government.
It's the end of the courts.
Yeah, it just goes on and on. Yeah,
it's true.
And it's all because of representation.
Yeah.
That representation inherently hates limits.
Yeah.
And so it's done away with limits. Mm-hmm. And so now it can go anywhere and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it does. But the problem is because of liberalism being simply anxiety formation, it always just goes to like terrible things.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I would say that, you know, let's say we had a Democrat president.
Mm-hmm.
I would even say that I'm not sure. I think right now, obviously, worst case scenario thinking is the direction that gigantism and anxiety has taken us and liberalism is taking us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I remember when Joe Biden was president, for instance, the gigantism had a whole different quality. And that was that Joe Biden was the new Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that he was one of the greatest presidents we've ever had, or that just that he was a president and not just a vegetable, or that he was fixing the country. Like the gigantism just had a more, you know, or Kamala Harris running and she's going to be president. Well, you know, if she can be president, she'll save America.
Right.
And to be fair, people on the right engage in such gigantic thinking as well.
Yeah, definitely.
But I would say liberals do it. I would say liberals do it more.
Yeah.
It's more a part of the liberal conceptual machine.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I would say the most surprising thing that I found when I transitioned from liberalism to conservatism. The most surprising thing was that conservatism does not inherently have anything to do with what liberals think it has to do with, which is hatred, resistance, prejudice.
Other gigantic things.
Yeah. That there's actually this massive space in conservatism for particularist, reasonable, scientific, event-based thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually an ideas philosophy that is bereft of gigantic ideational formations based on anxiety. There's more room for ideas in conservatism than there is in liberalism, I would say.
I feel like another reason I've seen that is that in liberalism, if you don't 100% agree with everything that's in the party line,
right,
you're basically, you know, wrong or bad or something. But I've seen more in conservatism that, like, there's just more understanding that there are different viewpoints, I guess.
Yeah.
And letting people kind of speak and have different viewpoints and letting that be okay and not gigantic and scary.
Right.
You know, they actually, I feel like, I've seen more from the conservatives that, like, it's okay that some people are pro-choice and some people are not pro-choice.
Right.
Whereas from the liberals, I have seen it's not okay that some people are
Not I mean, there are pro-choice and pro-life conservatives.
Yeah.
There are no pro-life liberals.
Right.
You're not allowed to be.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He did use the word dogmatic somewhere in here, didn't he?
Yeah.
Can't remember
So, anyhow, That's interesting, right?
Yeah, it is interesting. The representation thing is really interesting. I mean, I don't know. I always like it when you like wrap it up with relating it all to anxiety. And I know you're going to say that all liberalism is anxiety, but...
Done. It's wrapped up.
I just did it for you, obviously. But you often have something a little more to say than that.
I mean... I don't know if I do.
I had this like random image, like I think it was yesterday, and it was sort of like based in the movie The Matrix, but I kind of imagine that anxiety was like literally in a different box somewhere else. And like, that like in another world, right? And in like, or in however many years, or in another world, or let's just say when we come out of this age of anxiety that we're in, and actually anxiety is not the core of one's thinking, and it's like just sort of somewhere else, and there, those are sort of like, I don't know, some people have problems over somewhere else. And I was like, wow, that's just kind of crazy to think that anxiety doesn't have to be essential, and like liberalism doesn't have to be essential to one's thinking. And that I think you had said in some recent episode that was like, yeah, what happens? Like maybe we're in the dark ages still. Like this is the new dark ages, or, you know, it's the anxiety ages, but that it is possible that like in 100 years people would look back at it and be like, wow, what religious fanatics, how crazy was that? So I don't know, I thought that was kind of,
yeah, I think that's really good. I mean, I recently used in a TikTok I did, I said we're in the dark ages of the religion of identity. Mm-hmm. Like I think we think we're in this enlightenment phase, we've left religion behind. But I would say we're in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. of the identitarian religion, and mm-hmm. Liberalism is fueling that religion. It's the priest class of that religion, and that I mean I do sense that probably in a number of years they will look back and say that those people were still incredibly obsessed with identity, and not just race and gender and all the stupid social templates of identity, but identity is at the core of representation, mm-hmm. and the experience of representation. I mean, representation has become, with those examples we just gave of liberals having experiences with representations and not with events, representation has become a kind of God. A kind of abstract universal force that determines the path of humanity, mm-hmm. right, according to the people who believe in it. So it's mm-hmm. become a giant belief system. Mm-hmm. It's become as fantastical and in a sense delusional as the medieval god was in terms of explaining why things are happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, representation has become, that's the great irony of liberalism, is that they're the science people, mm-hmm. they're the facts people, but their obsession with representation is so saturates their thinking that just like the, you know, in the Middle Ages you would say, oh, God caused the plague. Mm-hmm. Liberals now say things, you know, as just as stupid, such as, you know, well, what that represents, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What that represents is causing all kinds of things in our society. Mm-hmm. They have the same kind of causal religious delusions that existed 1,000 years ago in tiny enclosed medieval towns, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we do live in the dark ages, and I think, but you know, we'll probably always live in the dark ages. But you know, I think anxiety is the new hysteria. Anxiety is the new I'm not sure what the word is, but I'm sure there was kind of this emotion back in the days of the predominance of the Christian religion of one being a sinner. And having great anxiety over whether one was going to go to heaven or hell.
Yeah, well, that's why you had to like confess and stuff. Right?
Yeah, so there was, you know, there was the original sin anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, I mean, of course, Heidegger said in some other books that, you know, anxiety is what it is to be alive. But, you know, I would say there's a lot of being alive that is not anxiety, too, in my view. I read this beautiful section of Sloterdijk's book. What is it? His book is I can't remember. I'm reading it right now. Sloterdijk. Infinite Mobilization. And in that book, he talks about Heidegger's and a lot of existentialists' mm-hmm. emphasis on death being determinant, the great determinant of what it means to be alive. And he posited the idea that maybe we should think about birth as being really the determinant of what it means to be alive and how we are born, what we are born into. He says something intriguing. What does he say? He says, as a creature, humans are in a sense not born into the world when they're born. So they're born into the promise of a world, and that displacement determines their life as a creature capable of promise, a creature who is owed something, a creature who can make promises. And he talks a lot about the mother being mothered, coming out of the mother, blah blah blah. Just all these formative forms that determine life. And so, I mean, I think also like, you know, anxiety, you know, maybe we're just too fixated on death. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I had a thought that the other day that I think my emphasis on non-identity and getting beyond identity and escaping identity and trying to have experiences outside of identity and I think somehow I feel that maybe somewhere in there is a bit of a solution to the fear of death that we fear death, or not even fear death. I mean, I think everything fears death, but we dread death even in the presence of comfort and non-threateningness. Mm-hmm. So we think ahead to our death mm-hmm. with sadness and trauma and dread mm-hmm. only because we are identitarians. That we identify with being alive, we identify with this earth, and we think that this earth without our identity is sad. Or that our identity is somehow integral to this earth. Or just in a sense that we just identify as being alive and that identity informs us. So there's something about how we identify with life that creates the dread of death. And if we could disidentify or have a life relationship that doesn't involve identity, then death would not be so dreadful. I'm not saying we then like go and run into traffic because we don't care about, we don't want to die. Like, you don't, it's okay. There's a difference between not wanting to die and being kind of traumatized by the fact that you're gonna. eventually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? Those are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the trauma of eventual death is very wrapped up in identity. And that's the kind of thing that I think maybe looking back on our era, people will see as a feature of our identitarian culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that ties in with anxiety. I mean, I think anxiety has a problem with its confusion between dread of general death
mm-hmm.
and possible specific imminent death.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So, you know, this isn't the profoundest thought. I think people have said this all over the place, but you know, a knife sitting on the counter is scary to you as a possible imminent threat of death because somehow your general traumatic dread of death or just the fact that you're going to die has made its way via some underground channel
mm-hmm.
into your current thinking. And you're manifesting that dread and that trauma and that disappointment at the mm-hmm. idea of dying through fear of the knife.
Mm-hmm.
And not being able to separate those two experiences of death, the one possible death of an imminent possible action versus just the general bummer of a deal that it is that you have to die, right?
Yeah.
They get colluded and you're having an emotional reaction to one that's actually about the other, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's well said. And maybe that is and somehow something I feel of a mix of quantity into quality or something.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I think identity is the conduit that allows those two experiences to come together and form one emotional traumatic experience.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And if you could disidentify them or sort of exist beyond identity, then they wouldn't get so colluded. And I think you could use the idea of identity as a conduit as well that channels the quantitative into the qualitative
mm-hmm.
and turns the gigantic from sublime to the terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Totally. Well said.
So.
Yeah, that's nice.
All right, I'm tired.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's over. Thank you, everybody. Everybody. All right. Yeah, I'm going to turn off the computer. Hopefully we've been recording. We have.
Yay.
All right. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.